I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're going team by team.
I would be very careful about slinging stone.
Am I going to get sued?
Are we going legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
More NFL teams hunting for head coach candidates. That's how we're going to start this show.
You just went
right in, right in.
No look, cold. Like I guess that is a cold open.
Right. I read once. That's how Al Michaels does it. Right. You don't need the preamble. You don't need the introduction. You don't need welcome in. You just start talking. Right.
Well, the camera now I've ruined live. It by making you explain yourself.
No. The camera goes live. You just start. You just rock right in.
We're going to do explain the grade later. Now we're doing explain the segment.
Yeah, explain the opening of the show. Yeah. You're right. We're going to do all kinds of stuff. We've got to explain the grade later. We're going to talk about what the 49ers do with quarterback. We've got an email about email reacting to our discussion last week about toolsy quarterbacks and how you should approach that in the draft, as well as a lot of reaction to us ripping into Pete Traeger and the general discussion around quarterbacks last week before the AFC Championship game. But we're going to start with a little bit of news.
Did we get any email questions about dinosaurs?
No, not a one.
All right, I'll see you later.
Now, to be fair, we didn't give the email out last show. So
that's true.
We would be relying on people remembering it and then, you know, emailing in about dinosaurs.
If there's any dinosaur questions in the chat as I lean into the microphone, please go ahead.
Absolutely. But we will start with a bit of news that we missed last week, which is Frank Reich being hired to be the head coach of the Carolina Panthers. I like that move. Like, I generally don't love retread head coach hires as a concept. I think a lot of the times these are guys that haven't, you know, failed for a reason, and the reasons don't necessarily go away. I don't know that Frank Reich did a bad job in Indianapolis. I think he was the victim of circumstance more than a failure of his job. And actually, it's one case where I think a retread hire actually makes a ton of sense.
Well, he's a good coach, and I don't think that this year is any indication that he's not a good coach anymore.
Right.
That's pretty much how I feel about it. They're giving him a new quarterback every year. They've been good. Like, well, two of them have been good. You know, Philip Rivers ended up being good. They made the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Matt Ryan was supposed to be good, and his arm fell off this year. And that
also everything else around it.
Yeah, and then the next thing is like, okay, well, if the quarterback is aging before your own eyes, the offensive line was supposed to be good and
right.
It was not at all. And then the receiving core, we always knew it was going to be an average at best receiving core. So like, there's no elite unit. There's like an elite player on the team, but that's about it. And it's like, so never had a chance to like rebuild an offense that was consistent through year to year. Like, you don't have any continuity, you're always changing and stuff like that. So I'm not surprised that they weren't good, even though I believed in them at the beginning of the season. But now you look back and you're like, oh yeah, it makes sense that they weren't good.
Yeah, and they kind of acknowledged that themselves when they were saying, you know, we didn't give Matt Ryan what we sold him. You know, like, we brought him over to work behind this great offensive line and the running game with Jonathan Taylor and these receivers that are moving in the right direction, maybe aren't quite there yet. And that just wasn't the reality of what showed up this year, particularly that offensive line that really collapsed before rebuilding itself a little bit towards the back end of the season. But yeah, all of this, I think, is just reasons why, you know, Frank Reich didn't stop doing a good job. It's just he became the fall guy for the, like, this is how the NFL works, right? You get to the end of the year, not even the end of the year in their situation. You reach the midway point, the owner gets pissed off, the owner just fires somebody randomly because that's how you do things at the NFL level, and Frank Reich becomes the fall guy for something that really wasn't his fault.
No, I don't believe it. I kept waiting for the turnaround, especially early in the season, because I, you know, obviously Matt Ryan makes good decisions most of the time. He's Matt Ryan. Like, he's a good quarterback. And then it just never happened because I think the arm just wasn't there this year. And then you add in the fact that the tackle group was horrific, right?
Certainly until like Ryman started to come on towards the end of the year, but it was rough for a while.
Yeah, like Matt Pryor is just like, that was not very good. So yeah, like I just can't believe that. I think that the Panthers are looking at themselves like, wait, Frank Reich is available?
Right. So for them, I think it's perfect because I don't think the Panthers are in a particularly bad spot, assuming they can find a quarterback. And they're in, you know, reasonable position to do that with a pretty high draft pick, with the capacity to go after one of the veterans if they want. Like, their position to try and give Frank Reich a quarterback, and all evidence over the last couple of years is if he has a viable quarterback, Frank Reich can craft a pretty good offense. And Carolina actually has a pretty good spot in terms of supporting cast for that guy already without doing anything in terms of wide receivers. The offensive line moved in a very healthy direction this past year.
Yeah, the important part there, I think.
And still has room to move. So, like, the Panthers' offense could be pretty good next year.
Look, I'm over Sam Darnold, however.
Yes.
I'm not – like, would it surprise you if Sam Darnold was the starting quarterback next year and they looked competent?
I mean, the first part of that would surprise me before we get to the second part. Like, if Sam Darnold is the starting quarterback week one, I would already be surprised. If Frank Reich then turned Sam Darnold into something vaguely competent, I could kind of see that. Okay. I'm actually kind of bummed that the Baker Mayfield thing went so badly that he gets shipped off and he's, you know, not there anymore, because Frank Reich with Baker Mayfield and that improved offensive line and the receiving core, et cetera, would be kind of interesting. But this is all because Frank Reich, I think, is a good hire and a good coach and should improve the prospects of whatever quarterback is there.
Yeah, I mean, do you think Matt Corral gets a shot, or do you think there's going to be a quarterback who was not on this roster last year who is going to probably be the week one starter?
I am working on the basis that the week one starter is not currently on the roster. I would be amazed if you turn the keys over to Matt Corral based off what you thought of him when you drafted him in the third round before he missed his entire rookie year with an injured foot. Like, that just doesn't seem — I don't think third round picks have that kind of tie to any organization that you believe in them that much that you're willing to actually give them a shot the next year based off literally no evidence whatsoever. It's like, if you see something special from them, sure, it changes everything, but I don't think they kind of earn that by default without, you know. So unless he's been doing something insane at the back end of this rehab, you know, or impressing them in meeting rooms or whatever, I can't see how he gets a shot at all.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's, especially in a draft like this, if this is last year's draft class, then things are very different. But I think with three guys who I think people think of, maybe even four guys people think of are top 10 picks, they're picking nine, maybe even a trade up candidate to go find if they really like a guy. I think there's a new quarterback there. And again, it's like, new coach, what are you going to do? Give him a new quarterback. Like, let's start this thing together, right?
Right, it's part of the bargain, essentially. So then let's talk a couple of minutes as well about the other side of that equation, which is the Colts, who got rid of Frank Reich, installed Jeff Saturday as the interim head coach, and now seem intent on installing him as the head coach just once they can get through as many rounds of interviews as it becomes necessary to convince other people that they've done their due diligence. But that seems to be the way this is going, right? Like, Jim Irsay, for whatever reason, wants Jeff Saturday coaching this football team.
Yeah.
Jordan Schultz is reporting that Saturday remains Irsay's number one choice for the job. Then says, while others in the Colts front office, quote, prefer different leading candidates, which I initially read as prefer decent candidates. Why? Why would you? Why?
Because you have so much money.
Yeah.
You have more money than I can ever even imagine having.
Uh-huh.
And you don't have any oversight. Like, there's no like, if you're a millionaire, not even a millionaire, I mean, multimillionaire, like, there's no oversight. You just do whatever you want.
But you do want to win. Like, they fire.
Right, but he believes. But I'm saying, like, he believes. So it's like, he believes Jeff Saturday is the right choice. Now,
but
he believes it because they're the interpersonal relationship between him and Saturday, and there's no one above him because he believes he's infallible because he made him a lot of money. That this is, of course, I'm right.
So
because I made right decisions 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
Isn't
so
he
I'm
one
gonna
of these,
continue to be right.
Isn't he like a legacy owner? Didn't he inherit this somewhere?
That's a good question.
I forget, but I can get why you would install Jeff Saturday, sort of, as the interim head coach. Like, remember, this was when this hire was made, there were quite a lot of people that used the term insulting, you know, to the process, to the other candidates, to people that generally get these jobs. Like, that's how out of left field that hire was, that NFL people said that this was like a slap in the face to other people that, that deserve to get these kind of jobs. But I think you can make the argument that, look, this isn't, and by the way, they didn't, which is why I was always skeptical about it. Like, this was quite an easy sell if you choose, if you chose to go this route, to the media, to the public, whatever, to say that, look, this is not an X's and O's coaching position. Head coach is an interpersonal job. It's a culture thing. It's a leadership role. And this man has been a leader of men. He was the NFLPA president when he was a player. He's been in a locker room with great leaders, blah, 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 blah. You could have done all that. And I actually think it would have made some degree of sense. It's still a sort of outside the box hire, but, you know, whatever. How can you make that argument after what he did as the coach?
Well, they're going to – well, because you can always blame it. I mean, I agree with you. I'm just saying, like, the devil's advocate is, like, you could just blame it on the fact that, you know, Ellinger started and –
but that was his own fault. Like, he put Ellinger as the starter.
I don't know. I think this is – it's not – if this happens, it's not a great hire.
I just don't even understand how you can make the argument at this point. I get it midseason, kind of. I think you could sell that to somebody. But having seen what happened, which is – one random ass win against the Raiders and Josh McDaniels, who wasn't exactly going well himself, then the biggest collapse in NFL history, then getting outscored like an 11 billion to 1 in the fourth quarter for the last however many games, just getting wrecked on this sequence of losses. How can you possibly sell that this is the guy?
No, I don't think you can. But
so how
matter.
Does he believe it himself?
Because they're friends. He likes it.
I get it, but
that's it.
Stay his friend. I don't understand how a billionaire that genuinely wants to win.
But there's also, like, you can fool these people, I believe. You can fool them. Because, like, Saturday we'll come and talk to them and be like, hey, this thing was bad. We got to change it. This thing is bad. I can change that. This thing should be done better, and we can do that. And I can, like, I don't know. Maybe Saturday is a good orator.
Yeah.
Here's the story of the Irsay family.
Okay, gotcha.
Just the one line on Wikipedia.
Perfect.
Robert Irsay, the father.
Yeah, there we go.
Owned the Baltimore Colts. But, wait a minute. He only owned the Colts after initially purchasing the Los Angeles Rams and then swapping franchises with Colts owner Carol Rosenblum.
Okay.
That's it. That's the one line about
like
this.
Like an even swap?
I guess so.
Like for like?
Yeah.
Because that doesn't feel like a great deal.
Do you think they added like a pick in there?
Right. Like something, you know, like a business or like a car right. or something. There's got to be a make weight. Like, where's the Jared Goff in this trade?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. This is it. This is all Wikipedia is giving me.
Yeah. But my point being that, like, Jim Irsay wasn't some business savant that made a ton of money and therefore thinks he's a genius. Like, Jim Irsay inherited his franchise and his billions from somebody else.
Look, if you have billions, you think you're a genius. No matter how you got it. I mean, I think we have a history of this throughout the course of the world.
But, like, don't you think it's an easier sell mentally, internally, for, like, David Tepper to think, look, I know how this shit works. I'm a genius. Okay, I've made billions.
The difference being that I agree with you that Tepper, in his, like, first couple of years, is thinking, no, everything I've touched turns to gold.
Right.
And do it. But Irsay is thinking, okay, everything I touched 15 years ago turned to gold. So it'll happen again.
The bottom line just keeps going up. I must be amazing at this. Okay. Maybe that has more to do with the league than you, Jim, but sure. Yeah. Knock yourself
just
out.
Just these guys who are like, Irsay truly believes in all of the, whatever decisions he's made, rather than
right.
the absolute luck of Peyton Manning and
Andrew Luck. I will say Joey Molinaro has a really good video that you can find on Twitter and his page that's like a mock-up of Jim Irsay and Chris Ballard having a conversation about the coaching hire that is very worth your while watching, a couple of minutes long. And it's probably quite close to the truth, which is the scary thing for Colts fans. So anyway, they're going to keep going through a second round of interviews and possibly a third, according to the insiders on Twitter, to ultimately unveil Jeff Saturday as the head coach and rejoice in that. All right, fair enough. All right, let's get through to the rest of the show. We got an email about, we were talking a lot last week, I think it was with Trevor, about the new sort of or the relative recent success of toolsy quarterbacks, and whether there's sort of learnings to be taken from that and what you should do and blah, blah, blah. And this email is from Jason, who says, guys, I've enjoyed the discussion on drafting toolsy quarterbacks. With all the various quarterback gurus out there, what are your thoughts on doing the exact opposite of what we talked about? Draft football IQ and intangibles and work to improve the physical tools. Joe Burrow put in work between years one and two with Jordan Palmer. Brock Purdy worked with the quarterback collective between college and the NFL to improve his ball velocity from the bottom of the league to a league average. Might it be just as easy to improve tools as football IQ and intangibles? Is there a money ball opportunity here? I'd love to hear your thoughts. So I think that's an interesting element of like this whole new world now of these individual coaches, not even necessarily quarterbacks, but like league-wide specific individual coaches that work almost outside of the team environment. Is there scope now to attack the opposite way and say tools can be improved just as much as anything else? So let's take a guy that clearly knows what he's doing and try and get his arm 25% better.
Yeah, this is not an obvious, there's no obvious answer to this question. I think it's like we're still trying to figure out why quarterbacks succeed in the NFL.
Right.
We're going to continue trying to figure this out. I think you can improve. I think there's stuff that we don't consider physical traits that probably are physical traits that we can improve, which would help with like the IQ aspect of it. I think you can improve soft focus, peripheral vision, those type of things, which maybe guys don't do often. I mean, we are stuck to like the mechanical aspect of like how the body releases a football.
Right.
Which I think is super important. We saw that change with Josh Allen being able to actually throw the ball accurately after his second year because they fixed issues with the sequencing and his hips and stuff like that. But I think what we don't do enough is fix eyesight and
right.
fix decision making, which you can do. You absolutely can do from these individual quarterback coaches and stuff like that. But I mean, to like again, going back to it, it's like, should you draft tools guys and fix it? Should you draft, you know, quote unquote IQ guys and fix it? It's like, man, we just don't know. It makes sense to draft the tools guy and then hope that you can fix the rest, because you can get yourself out of trouble if you're the tools guy more than other guys can, and especially early on in a career where you're going to be in trouble because you don't understand enough about defenses and all that stuff, you know, whether it's coverage or you know, pass protection and stuff like that. So I certainly understand that, but that still doesn't. Then it's like, okay, so like I maybe do kind of lean on that side, but I'm like, there's still too many guys who have tools who don't work out, and it's like there's just not a lot of quarterbacks who work out at the level that we want them to work out at. Just 15, maybe 15, who were like, this guy, I'd like him back for another season on my team.
Yeah, I think the other thing is. So the sort of notion of you take a guy with all the physical tools in the world and get him better at one aspect of like mental processing, decision making, accuracy, whatever it is, and immediately that's a huge difference in what that guy is. You can, I think, play around the edges of physical abilities. I think there's a lot of these things that you can improve on. You can up arm strength. Obviously, Aaron Rodgers throws the ball differently now than he did when he came into the NFL. You can definitely improve even things like physical speed. Like you can learn how to, by the mechanics of throwing, you can learn how to, the mechanics of running, you can get faster, you can get slightly stronger, you can get slightly bigger. What you can't do is turn Cody Kessler into Josh Allen. Like, you know, no amount of sending him into the short of adding some, you know, supplements, illegal supplements on the side, you're just simply not going to change that guy into the kind of tools that Josh Allen has at his disposal. It's not in the range of outcomes anywhere. So then you're sort of saying, well, if we improve this by 20%, this by 20%, this by 20%, what is the sum total of that? And it's still 50% of what Josh Allen is right out of the box. So it's easier to try and take the guy with these tools and move one thing and see if we can get him there, I think, than it is to take a guy with great football IQ and great accuracy and whatever and hope that the sum of four different physical improvements, which you might not have the time to do collectively or the ability to do collectively, gets him anywhere near that gap. Yeah. I just think there are some guys where, like, the benefit that you get from being a true difference maker physically is so different from where these guys are to start with.
Yeah, I think you're also able to stick around in the league longer. Like, I think I was thinking about, like, the difference between, like, okay, I mean, Josh Allen is the obvious example. So you look at him, and then you look at, like, Josh Rosen. And it's like, it is like Josh Rosen could not, they could not give you, put you on the field, right? Like, Josh Allen, even though he didn't know what he was doing for the first 2 years, or at least the first year and a half, let's say, he could be on the field.
Right.
Because he could do something, right? He could get you somewhere. Well, that's
like, and Jalen Hurts.
Yeah,
like, if Jalen Hurts couldn't run, he probably wouldn't have made it to the point where he was able to improve as a passer. Like, they wouldn't have had him on the field that long. Same with, like, Justin Fields. If it turned out that Justin Fields wasn't as freaky dynamic as he is right now, would he have made it through last season given where he was as a passer? Yeah, and not all of it's his fault, right? Like, who was he throwing to? What was the offensive line? What was the offense? Blah, blah, blah. But my point being, if he didn't do what he did as a runner, he probably doesn't make it through that season. So having that ability enables you to, it buys you a lot of time to fix other things. Whereas if you, again, if you're the sort of, you're really smart, you make smart decisions, but you get murdered every play, or you can't get out of anything, or you can't make half the throws, people don't give you the time to fix those things.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's like, no one wants to give you the time to sit on the bench before you start, or put you back on the field after, once you get benched, man. It's
and I think
to go back.
It also probably plays into this self-fulfilling prophecy thing of, like, I think one of the biggest elements of how much time a guy gets, how much leeway they're given, all those kinds of things, is simply draft status, right? And generally speaking, the guys drafted at the top are not the guys with marginal physical tools. So inherently, those guys are immediately...
Until Bryce Young gets drafted.
Right. But even Bryce Young, like, has a good arm. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
if you're a
Cody Kessler type, right?
Those guys,
I don't want to keep picking on Cody Kessler, but, like, those guys are drafted in the middle of the draft, right?
Yeah.
They're third rounders, which means you get 5 minutes to show you've got anything, and then you're done, right? Whereas if Cody Kessler, if he was just taken in the top 10.
Well, this is what I say about Josh Allen all the time. It's like, you know, you looked at him and his tape from Wyoming, and you're like, well, he's not a top 10 quarterback. But because that's what ended up happening,
right,
he was able to get reps in game. Because as we know, like, bad quarterbacks don't get reps unless it's in the game.
Yeah.
So, like, you don't get practice reps. So, yeah, I agree with that.
And there are exceptions to all this. But, like, generally speaking, like, if Cody Kessler had been a top 10 pick, he might have had longer to work as a starter and get, like, potentially progress physically. But because he isn't, he's a third round pick, it's like, you get one shot at this, and if you can't do it, we're done with you. Like, you're out of there. And it does become fascinating because Josh Allen is a good example, but then Malik Willis, right? Malik Willis ends up getting drafted in the third round when people thought he might go in the first. And now, is his time in Tennessee already over? Like, he got 5 minutes, it was a disaster, and it's like, right, sit down, Josh Jobs is taking it from here. Like, if that was, again, Josh Allen, or if Malik Willis had been drafted in the first round,
they're
going to stick with him, right? Like, they're not signing Josh Dobbs. Malik Willis is going to have the offense built around him, and we're going to figure out what we can do with him. But that's the difference that simple draft status makes. So I think that, until that changes, if it ever does, I think these guys that are sort of high in football IQ and those kinds of things, but low in physical tools, are just automatically behind the eight ball because they're never going to get given the opportunities that the toolsier guys are going to get given, even if on a level playing field, it might have the same opportunity of working out well.
Yeah, and I also think, like, you look at, you almost can't get to the high levels of college football having great seasons in college football unless you have those tools as well. Like,
sure,
there's no one coming out who like doesn't have, like, even Burrow. You know, we talk about Burrow as like this like cerebral guy, blah blah blah. I mean, he made sickening plays outside the pocket in 2019. Like, that's what.
And
took
he's still
them.
A good athlete.
He is a
his
good
arm
athlete.
Is still fine. Like,
yeah,
it's not.
But he was making, you know, the play against Georgia when he runs around like three times behind the line of scrimmage and then finds I forget who, Chase or whatever, in the end zone. It's like he was making those type of sick plays all the time. Like, you can't get there. like they're not going to draft you to begin with unless you're doing that type of stuff in college already.
Yeah, I think the interesting question is almost if you start with a higher baseline, like if you take a guy that it doesn't have marginal physical tools but is just average and he's really smart and he has high football IQ, like how high can you push that guy's physical tools knowing that he's already okay, as opposed to let's take somebody who has marginal physical tools and see how good we can make them. Like, I think you probably need to start with a high enough baseline that it's viable anyway, and then figure out if you can really push that to the limit.
There's also like not a lot of dummies at this position who got drafted. Like the level of quarterback play over the last 10, 15 years has been significantly upgraded, that you're getting so many reps in passing offenses in high school, in college, to lead you to the NFL that you're not, you've seen so much already.
Right.
That like the baseline level for quarterbacks coming out is so good right now. Like, I know we like to make fun of like Mitchell Trubisky and whatever, and it's like Mitchell Trubisky is like, he's such a good quarterback.
Relatively, yeah.
Relatively, right? He's like so good at playing the quarterback position, but he can't even get a second contract, right?
Yeah.
Like that's where it's like, you almost don't have a choice because the level is so high than just to say, hey, Josh Allen's a freak. Like, let's do it.
It is fascinating when you see like any insight into what these guys are thinking sort of in the 2 seconds post-snap between the ball being snapped and them having to get rid of it. You remember a couple of years ago, Kirk Cousins did some random ass draft series where he was talking to draftable quarterbacks. And there was a lot of it was terrible, but the sort of fascinating part is there was like 2 minutes where he had them up on a chalkboard or whatever. And Cousins talking to these guys about like their favorite play and how it differs from like, oh, yeah, that's a play that everybody runs in the NFL. Here's what I'm looking at. And like him running through all the things he's doing just to execute like a simple hook route to a tight end. It's like nobody has the appreciation that that's what's going on pre and post snap. It's just like, oh, that's just a simple drop back, hit the tight end. It's like he's looking two different players further on in order to check that that's even viable, and that leads him here. And it's like Cousins, every single one of these guys, you know, gave their play, and Cousins A, knew what it was, B, knew the differences between that and like three other offenses that he's already been in. And it's like, and this is a guy that gets crapped on for being an average, at best, NFL quarterback. Like, this is the level these guys are at, that even someone that most people think is rank average is operating in this like football savant plane that nobody else, and time crunch savant plane that nobody else can even think about.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm always like so impressed by these players who, I think Mahomes is why he's so impressive, is because everyone wants to believe that he's this guy who just makes a bunch of plays outside the pocket, but he really is a savant in the pocket. Like he's really good.
Yeah.
And then his uniqueness is obviously his ability to make throws off structure but still be accurate and find open receivers when he's outside of the pocket, which like so it's much easier said than done always. I also wanted to add in, like, you know, there was talk last week, I missed it, you know, you guys talking about it, but this whole idea of like, not to call anyone out, but the Patrick Mahomes is the best player, but Joe Burrow is the best quarterback.
Mm.
And I know we've had these discussions, I'm not a big basketball guy, but I know we've had these discussions in basketball for like, Michael Jordan's the best basketball player,
right,
but LeBron is the best player or whatever. And it's like, I don't understand what Patrick Mahomes is doing that he's not playing quarterback, apparently.
Yeah, that was a weird distinction to draw. We're going to circle back to that because we got a bunch of emails and comments about that later on. I want to come back to that at the end of the show. But first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of Super Bowl 57. They've got all the Super Bowl action you need. New customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. Plus, all customers can get in on the Super Bowl 57 excitement with DraftKings Happy Hour Super Boosts. Check out the DraftKings Sportsbook app every day between 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern. to see what the prop bet will be boosted. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use the code PFF. New customers can bet $5 on Super Bowl 57 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly, only at DraftKings Sportsbook with the code PFF. So, sticking with the quarterback theme, I'm curious now what the 49ers are going to do at quarterback next season, because for the second year in a row, Kyle Shanahan has essentially closed the door on Jimmy Garoppolo. This time it seems much more likely that it will be true because they don't need to get a trade partner. They can just see ya. Trey Lance obviously was supposed to be the guy this year, the guy they've got three first-round draft picks tied up in. Didn't happen, and when he's played, he's looked like the least effective of the 49ers quarterbacks over the last couple of years. And then obviously they had the Brock Purdy thing this year. Put up crazy numbers. The production was through the roof. Incredible story. PFF grade never quite matched that, but then you have the complicating factor of also the dude like tore his elbow to pieces and now is on the shelf for at least 6 months potentially, and who knows, maybe more if it's Tommy John and blah, blah, blah. So also, by the way, Tom Brady just retired. So a potential option for them that might have ticked a lot of boxes, short term, very good team, blah, 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 doesn't seem to be an option anymore. So where does that leave them?
You know, I still, as an outsider, not in the building, I still want to see what Trey Lance is.
Right.
Like we just haven't seen a lot of Trey Lance, like, play the sport of football in the past like five seasons, which is a problem.
Like ever, yeah.
But I would still like to see it. But I obviously understand that in the building they feel like this is they don't want to mess up what is a really good core of players, right? And this makes it so much more difficult. Like I'm still like, again, I still kind of believe in Trey Lance. He was a third overall pick, so like there's probably something there. You still have Kyle Shanahan, who makes every quarterback look very good. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm outside of the building, I'm Trey Lance, I think, is the way to go. But inside the building, I can understand why. But it's funny though, because like, let's look at the UFAs, right? Who, if you're gonna spend a moderate amount of money, you're not gonna like spend like huge amount on a quarterback. Who's the best quarterback that fits the 49ers roster right now? Well, it's Jimmy Garoppolo. Like, that's the problem. Like he continues to be the perfect fit, like placeholder to a certain degree, like he was last season, right? When before he got injured. So,
but that's the thing with him, yeah. Is like, even forget the kind of play or the potential cap to his how good he can be or blah blah blah. Just from his injury history, it makes sense that they were trying to move on from him. Like, just you literally can't trust that he will be there at the sharp end of the season any year. So it makes perfect sense that they were trying to go in a different direction anyway. That hasn't changed. In fact, it stayed the same, and it's just more evidence that that has to happen. So if you're even if you brought him back, you're still in the position of, at the very minimum, there needs to be a contingency plan that can step in and do the same thing. Now, maybe that is Brock Purdy. Well,
that's
again
the thing.
After,
so you still have Purdy and Lance like on the roster on rookie deals. So it's like,
but if Lance isn't the starter next year, you almost have to trade him, right? As a, like, otherwise, what do we do? We're just burning three draft picks.
Yeah, burning a lot of draft picks. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know who the, I just think like, the issue is going to be, where do they think they are at quarterback? Like, how much money do they feel like they need to spend at quarterback in free agency? Like, we're assuming that in this world, they don't like Trey Lance.
Right.
Brock Purdy's injury is not going to get better anytime soon before the season starts. So, like, now you're looking at a free agent quarterback, and it's like, are you going – I mean, I know there's, like there's not going to be a great amount of free agency quarterbacks. Like, Lamar Jackson obviously not – is going to be franchise tags or whatever, mm-hmm. or he'll sign. So it's like, man, like what? Like then what are we talking about here? Like, do you just do the whole Jimmy G thing again? But maybe now, I say again, not with Jimmy G, but do you do it with? I you know what I mean? Like, I don't know who's left for them to do this with, other than Lance, Purdy, or Jimmy.
What do you think in this offense is? Like, if Kyle Shanahan is looking for a quarterback, what are the traits he's looking for to execute this offense at a really high level. Because the weird thing is, Lance doesn't seem to be that. Whatever you think it should be, it doesn't seem that Lance is the guy, which is what makes it so fascinating that he was the guy that they traded the first round three, or the three first round picks to get. And as you said, we're dealing with a stupidly small sample size for Trey Lance. Like, he has in his NFL career 124 dropbacks. Like, that's nothing. 102 pass attempts. Like, we're talking nothing. But in that time, he has a turnover-worthy play rate of almost 4%, which is high, right? Like, he's making mistakes. And it feels like the thing that made Brock Purdy look so good is being able to paint by numbers and not screw it up.
Yeah.
And that was always the sort of, if Jimmy G has a flaw, it's that every now and again he's going to make one of those terrible mistakes, and that's where the problem arises. But, like, it feels like if Shanahan gets a quarterback that just does what he tells him to do, or, like, paints by numbers, just takes the open stuff and doesn't make a mess of it, he will get that guy cooking. And then where he runs it, like, the difference between Jimmy G winning games and Nick Mullins and C.J. Beathard or whoever losing games is that those guys make more mistakes than he does. And those mistakes are what transforms, like, production and wins into just production, not wins.
I will say that I think that, you know, taking Trey Lance with his skill set coming out was a choice to say, okay, well, you know, he's like, even if it's not the greatest passer in the world, like, now I'm getting more out of my running game. I'm getting some scramble ability, and I'm good enough. I'm Kyle Shanahan. I'm good enough to do the paid by numbers thing with literally anyone.
Right.
And I think so. I think he can fit this offense around Trey Lance if he needs to. So I don't know if it's necessarily that, like, he doesn't fit in the Kyle Shanahan offense, because I think they wanted to do some different stuff. You know, they wanted to play more pistol. They wanted to run more read option, do all that stuff. So I think there's a chance that he still feels like that's the way to go. And I think that's actually just interesting from Shanahan's perspective, which is like, he's been so good at this particular thing, and just getting these guys to the right read over the middle of the field, no turnovers, and we'll just, we have this really good running game and really good yak receivers, and we'll just, I just need you to do this, like, one thing. And even him saying, okay, well, I need to expand it. Like, eventually this is going to come to an end, and it kind of didn't with Purdy. Purdy is obviously a different quarterback than Jimmy G, and I think he expands the offense in a way that I think Kyle probably liked, throwing the ball outside the numbers once in a while. Like, hey, we have really good receivers. Let's throw them the ball outside.
And extending
sometimes.
The play and extending the scramble type play, scramble type passes.
Yeah, he just doesn't have the quick release and the zip that I think Jimmy has, which is why Jimmy can operate over the middle of the field.
Right. But doesn't it also feel like the one thing that undermines the entire offense is if you're going to make mistakes and create turnovers? It's like, you know, I think that's the thing, is he can get production and offensive success out of literally any quarterback by the paint by numbers thing. But the difference between, like, that being successful and winning games and not is how many times are you going to throw the ball to a linebacker?
Yeah.
Because if you do that two times a game, those are possessions we can't make up. Now, maybe they are if the defense stays as amazing as it is, but, like, that's the thing that undermines all of that, and that's the one sort of the biggest flaw right now in what we've seen in the really small sample size of Trey Lance. The other thing that I find interesting is I was in love with anybody with the prospects of what Trey Lance was going to allow Kyle Shanahan to do with that offense, but it almost feels like he doesn't need it anymore because he traded for Christian McCaffrey, and the sort of collective of McCaffrey, Juszczyk, Debo, George Kittle, Brandon Ayuk, like, all these guys together, A, is the best group of skill position players in the NFL. B, they're all, like, matchup nightmares. And deployed collectively, it's like, I don't need any wrinkles. Like, this is already unstoppable. Again, if you give me just the paint-by-numbers guy, like, this guy can't fail.
We win 10 straight games.
Right, like, if as long as he doesn't throw the ball to a safety twice a game, there's no way this can lose. So, like, I don't need the extra stuff anymore. Like, maybe I did when we threw the three first-round picks to go get him, but now I just need a guy who's not going to turn the ball over.
And then you can find that guy in free agency for not $30 million, right, for like a lot less than that. Even if it's just a 1 year or 2 year deal, I think you can find that. Though I just don't know. I'm looking at the free agents at quarterback, and there's not a lot.
But that's where I think it becomes kind of interesting. Like, does a guy like Kyle Shanahan, understanding everything we just talked about, say, if you give me Teddy Bridgewater for $5 million a year, like, I can make that guy look like a Pro Bowler?
I probably thinks that way.
Right.
He probably thinks that way.
I mean, that wouldn't...
Because Teddy Bridgewater is a good quarterback.
Sure, relatively. But like, but that, and also, he's just come from the same system.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There's, but like, you know, everyone's going to start... I mean, we were talking Tom Brady at the start of this. Obviously, that's theoretically off the table now. But like, that's the kind of quarterback people are going to be talking about. Like, legitimate, proven, caliber, high-level starters. But actually, or like a Jacoby Brissett. Can Kyle Shanahan actually look at this and say, I can shop in the bargain basement bin and actually turn any one of these Muppets into a Pro Bowler as long as he doesn't turn the ball over?
Well, you almost think it's not – you might as well.
Like,
because you're still trying to figure out – like, yeah, you take a Brissett, Dalton, Bridgewater, one-year deal, whatever it may be, less than $10 million, $5 million, whatever it is. And then you still kind of work with the fact that, hey, I have these two kind of potential wild cards in my back pocket on rookie deals, and
right.
I'm okay with them. And I can, I have confidence in myself to say Andy Dalton, who, by the way, had a pretty good season this mm-hmm. year, might be back to like those baseline Andy Dalton levels
right.
rather than the last 2 years with the Cowboys and the Bears. And hey, Andy Dalton fits that system tremendously.
Yeah,
making the right decisions, getting the ball to the skill position players, like, you could do that. So yeah, I think that probably is what they end up doing.
I also think, by the way, that they can, like, I mean, you can never sort of sacrifice a big chunk of the season, but you can work on the basis that, hey, Brock Purdy by week 8 is going to be healthy. Like, I don't even need a year-long starter. I need a guy that can get me through 8 games, like almost like the Browns did with Brissett this year. It's like, we hit the theoretically, the White Knight is riding in on week 11. Like, how can we get to week 11 in a viable situation? Like, the 49ers are potentially looking at this and saying, I don't need a guy that's going to play from week 1 through the Super Bowl. I need a guy that can get me through 8 games and be 5-3.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who's that guy? And that could be any of these people, essentially.
Yeah, I think the issue is like, does I, you know, whatever, I still don't really believe in Brock Purdy. I know the sample size keeps getting bigger and bigger, but it's like, now you're coming off he's going to be coming off the UCL. As you said, the PFF grade, just like Jimmy Garoppolo, never matched the actual like EPA per play or yards per attempt or anything like that. So it's like, well, like, now you're going to get into the same situation where you're like, okay, he keeps winning games, and then you sign him to the big deal. Like, they signed Garoppolo to the big deal. And then you're trying to trade him.
Right. And I mean, I'm like, sad. I think I'm sad because I think the elbow injury potentially changes everything.
Yeah.
But that was becoming a really sort of fascinating dynamic of, the longer he plays like this, the harder it is to argue against it. And even if you're of the opinion that, like, the majority of the credit goes to Kyle Shanahan and their skill position players and blah, like, it almost doesn't matter. Like, the fact that he is the other piece that creates 35 points a game,
mm-hmm.
like, it doesn't make a difference,
yeah.
how good
I just still believe, I think what I'm always going to get back to is, I still believe right now in Lance to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Again, has it been good in that small sample size? Right. No. But he was still a young kid when he was drafted.
Sure.
With not a lot of experience. So it's like, I still believe that there's so much potential there.
To me, the biggest... not even a knock on Lance, but the biggest sort of caution for the Trey Lance thing would be, almost from day one, the 49ers have been very reserved with their, like, praise and just description of Trey Lance as the starter in this. Like, generally speaking, no matter what the guy is playing like, or how it's going, or what the performance looks like, teams are endlessly effusive with their praise of the guy that's supposed to be the future. Like, even look at the Jets now, right? Zach Wilson was benched and made the number three quarterback because he created a toxic locker room by refusing to take any responsibility for his own terrible play, right? Despite that, the team is still out there saying, oh, we believe in Zach. He just, it's a good reset for him. Like, he's going to be our guy. We haven't given up on him. Like, it's all going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Like, it can't go any worse than what's happened to him, and they're still defending into the hilt. Lance has only played like 100 and whatever snaps it was, and they've never really been like, oh, we're really excited. He's looking great. It's all going well. Like, he's just been unlucky. They've always been kind of, you know, a little bit reserved with how they're actually describing this whole thing, which doesn't fit right to me.
No, it makes me a little nervous for sure that it's just never going to be. But it's like, I come back to the same thing, because it's like, where does it have to be for him to be a successful player as a San Francisco 49er right. under Kyle Shanahan? And it obviously, it's different if he played almost anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if he could do this in whatever. I don't want to name, like, you know, quote-unquote bad offensive coordinators, but, like, this is the spot where it's like you still feel comfortable even if he's not making the smartest decisions every time, because he does so much other things well, and the paint by numbers thing, and you're hoping that it's enough.
Like, even this, there was a bunch of press conference clips doing the rounds the last couple of days where I don't know if Kyle Shanahan actually gets a disproportionate amount of dumbass questions from 49ers media, or if it just seems that way because of the ones that end up going on Twitter. But somebody basically asked him, like, oh, does your offense need to change because four quarterbacks got hurt? And he was like, well, obviously not if you actually look at how they got hurt, idiot. He didn't say idiot, I added that part. But even then, when he was sort of closing the door for the second time on Jimmy Garoppolo, it felt like that's a perfect chance to be able to pivot and be like, Trey Lance is our guy, remember, he was our starter, like, it's going to be great, he just got unlucky, got hurt, blah, you know, pivot the conversation and be like, hey, let's talk up Trey Lance. Instead, it was just like, no, we're going to drop kick Jimmy out of the room, okay, thanks, bye, see you tomorrow. You know, it's weird, I think, the way that they're treating that. Let's move past the 49ers thing. I want to talk about some draft quarterbacks. But first, we want to talk about Western Southern. The PFF NFL podcast is sponsored by Western Southern Financial Group. The people with the plaque on the wall, the fancy metal plaque, is the nicest thing in the studio. While you focus on your roster moves,
you're Western the nicest Southern, thing in the studio.
Thank you, sir. Western Southern helps advance your money moves. Buying your first home, planning and starting a family, wondering how to make your money grow, Western Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions helps you rest assured on game day. Team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. We're getting to draft time. And by that, I mean, sadly, it's February the 2nd. So
it's been draft time for like a month, really. Right. About it.
What I want to talk about is draft busts and how many of the biggest draft busts, like in history, are cautionary tales that have informed the league and that kind of thing can't really happen anymore? And how many are still just landmines waiting for teams to stumble into and there's nothing you could do to see it coming? Because I come back to this a lot. I found years ago a NFL draft preview magazine, like a hard copy, the ESPN magazine from 1998, the Manning versus Leaf thing, right? And in this magazine, there are a couple of different articles about this whole thing, but the one that jumps out the most is there's one article where a guy goes to interview Ryan Leaf, and he describes Ryan Leaf easing his gut into the hot tub after 2 months on the banquet circuit after the season. They described him as Chuck Wepner. You know who that is? He's this like old fat white dude that fought Muhammad Ali once, looking like some guy that they just dragged off the street. And he describes him as looking like that, easing his gut into this hot tub, whilst contrasting with the fact that Peyton Manning like hasn't left the Tennessee film room in the last 2 months other than to play golf and then get back in grinding tape. And it's like, this is not a hindsight thing. Like, we really should have been able to see this coming at the time. Like, did we just decide that this stuff didn't matter? Like, I don't think this happens anymore. Like, I think that the red flags for Ryan Leaf were so obvious that teams having been burned by Ryan Leaf simply don't make that mistake these days.
If we're going to specific with quarterbacks, the mistakes that we made for a long time was just like passing yards. like relief is probably a good example. I don't remember exactly the offense that he was playing in, but I would imagine you put up a ton of passing yards.
But that was also a physical tools thing, but it was saying this guy with his physical tools, he's just too good to pass up. It doesn't matter what any of the rest looks like. Like, okay.
Right, but it's like, it's only because he's only like the number, in discussion to be the first overall pick.
Right.
Because of in 1997 throwing for just a hair under 4,000 yards at 9.7 yards per attempt, right. 34 touchdowns, 11 interceptions, because no one knows how to stop the pass back then.
Right, but also, like, I think the missing part in, like, the discussion we had earlier is that, like, nobody is going to bat anymore for a guy that's, like, obviously an asshole. You know what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
Like, you can have all the physical tools in the world and people will be confident in your ability to fix the other stuff because they're confident that you're a hard worker and a leader and all the, like, Josh Allen for the first 2 years, all you heard about was how much everybody loves him and how he's, you know, grinding his ass off, and he will get there. Like, he's that kind of guy.
Like, something you didn't hear about Josh Rosen.
Right.
And that's not, I'm just saying this, you haven't heard that, not that it's true or not, but you guys haven't heard
And let's say if we're making the argument, the Zach Wilson thing, like that's, if you want to draw the analog that like, that's why he's failing right now, theoretically, right? Because of the lack of leadership and maturity. But I don't think those red flags were obvious in the same way they were with Ryan Leaf.
Yeah, and then with quarterbacks, it's still the toughest position as we know. And then when I think about Zach Wilson, I'm just like, well, our issue was like the tape wasn't actually that good at BYU. Like that was the issue. We were like, and I guess that plays into what you're saying about traits, because like we all thought we saw these traits that were like unmissable, that you had to have in the first round. Never mind the top, five picks or whatever, and then the actual tape him playing quarterback was just okay. But that also like plays into like the issue, like when we talk about traits in the discussion we had before, and Josh Allen keeps coming up, Josh Allen and even Herbert too, but it's like those are A+ traits. Like when we banked on Zach Wilson, we were banking on B+ traits. Like he'd get around the pocket a little bit. He could throw a deep ball, but it wasn't like he wasn't like insane velocity on his balls. He just like it's B+, maybe A-, but I'd probably say B+ is closer. So like that's what we have to bank on, A+ traits. Like we can't bank on other traits like that. So I think I'm just thinking about other positions though to kind of answer your question. And we kind of talked about it yesterday, but edge and defensive interior, like the whole D-line is a position that we've kind of solved just through that we probably won't make a lot of mistakes with, and then Javon Walker happens. So like,
right, that's the thing. So I will say that as much as you look at some, like the Ryan Leaf one is the obvious one,
yeah,
where you look back and you say, I don't think people would make that mistake today, because I think that taught people some lessons of, look, if there's one thing that's a definite no-go, like you just can't have, it's a guy with that kind of attitude, because that's going to be a problem. Like,
yeah.
Particularly at quarterback at the top of the draft where you're coming into a crappy team, like it's not going to be going well right away. You have to be able to get through that. And if you can't, you've got no shot. But when you look at some of the biggest draft busts of NFL history, quite a lot of them are quite recent. And they sort of tick these boxes that we're talking about of, it doesn't feel like he should have fallen for that. So Isaiah Wilson, I mean, that was the last couple of years. And again, that seems like one that it happens so fast that it feels like you should have seen that coming.
Yeah, I mean, you would love to like see the interviews with him, like the
yes,
private interviews, because that probably tells you the whole story there.
That spiraled out of control so fast that I find it very difficult to believe that you couldn't have seen that coming based
right,
off talking to him at any point
yeah,
in that process. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the dude was incredibly good at faking it until he had the money, and then
yeah,
as soon as he had the money, it was like different guy.
Love it.
But it feels like that's something you should have been able to see coming. Who else would be like Ryan Leaf, we talked about. Edge rusher is one that busts every now and again, and when it does, it's bad. So the one I think that you can't see coming at any point, and I don't think it's fair to even call them, well, no, I guess they are busts, but they're a different category, the injury ones. Like Courtney Brown was always injured. I think Keanna Carter, running back, was an injury one as well, right? Like, these guys that get injured badly and they're just never the guys that you thought they were going to be, I don't think that's even – obviously, you can never see that coming unless there's an extensive injury history and your doctors, blah, blah, blah. But they're, I think, in a different category. Who else would be in this list, though? Like, Jamarcus Russell is one of those biggest draft busts ever. And I think he seems to – he's in the same kind of category as Ryan Leaf of this is something you probably should have seen coming. Like, there's that legendary story, which I think started with Bruce, right? Didn't Bruce Gradkowski break this news that the Raiders didn't think he was watching tapes, so they sent him home with blank tapes and asked him, like, did he watch all those blitz packages? Like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's always going to be the issue is going to be like, do you have, it's like obviously takes a lot of willpower and energy and all that stuff to play at a professional sport league. Like, so that's probably the best example. It's just like, we'll never know as outsiders. Like, we're just never going to know. So we have to figure out other ways why these things might be issues.
Two more interesting ones that are sort of edge rusher defender type ones. Vernon Golson and Deion Jordan. So these were two guys that had off the charts athleticism and were picked really high. Golson was almost immediately terrible. Jordan, like, at least flashed the ability to do some stuff and then just never really materialized.
Third overall.
Golson, I think his thing is, if I remember rightly, his like explosiveness numbers were off the charts, but his change of direction numbers weren't. So like, he got compared to Trayvon Walker quite a bit because obviously athletic freak going high didn't necessarily have the production. But I don't think Golson had the kind of like the profile that we talked about with Walker, this one of a kind, absolute unique freak. And once you get to the NFL level, if you can't change direction, that's not going to fly for an edge rusher. Jordan, though, is one where I think the NFL still makes this mistake quite a lot of watching a guy do something at the college level, which is unusual for somebody of his dimensions, and then projecting that forward as, well, what if we do that 100% of the time? You're like, well, then you're just not that great at it. Like, he drops into coverage well for a defensive lineman, but he doesn't drop into coverage well for a linebacker.
Yeah.
And if you then ask him to be a linebacker, it's you just have an under, like a below average player.
A bad linebacker.
Right. I think the NFL still screws that up, which is why you get
Isaiah Simmons,
Hassan Reddick. Like, you get them shoehorning these guys into positions that they shouldn't really play based off looking quite good at doing that for a different position.
Yeah, I'm looking at Deion Jordan's 2012 stats at Oregon. He had 5 sacks and 10.5 tackles for loss.
Yeah.
Not very good. It's not a lot.
Right. But and so much of the hype was about, but look at him dropping the coverage for a guy that's whatever he is, like 6'6" and, you know, 260
pounds
or whatever.
The funny thing about that is, like, I think it's useful to once in a while drop your defensive end in coverage. Like,
of course.
Choice. It's like very, very good scheme, right? But it's once in a while.
Yes.
And you're really just getting in the way. Like, the whole point is like, oh, we fooled the quarterback. Not like, hey, we're going to stand there and you're going to cover a guy and you're going to understand your hook drop and you're going to understand like depth and all that stuff. It's like, we're just going to like, you just got to be there, kind of. So like, yeah, I agree. Like, that type of, those type of tweeners can be troublesome.
But I think you also need to look at, okay, yes, this is impressive for a defensive lineman, but you also need to put it in the context of what is it also impressive, like, for a guy that plays this position? Because if it isn't, then it's of limited use at the next level. Like, we either aren't going to ask him to do that a lot, or if we are, by our own definition, he isn't that great at it because we're saying he doesn't compare particularly well to a guy that does that all the time. That I think the NFL still screws that up, and that's why you get so many of these tweener guys don't work out.
Yeah, we often can look at the wrong things when it's like we really have to we can't look at a linebacker and be like, oh, he's a good blitzer when in college or even in the NFL. Like, you can't look at that stuff. You can't look at safety and say the same thing. Oh, he's a good blitzer, so it'll translate because he does something well. And it's like, well, you don't really do that often. And, yeah, I think there's probably those ideas. I'm trying to think of like other positions where we've been bad. I think receiver, the issue is contested catches. Like that's always going to be our biggest blind spot because they're fun. Like watching a guy go up and make a contested catch is super fun in college.
I think there are a few areas where like the league did learn from errors in the past. Like I don't think that now you get a Troy Williamson happening where a guy shows up to the combine, runs a 4.3 flat, and it's like, oh, that guy's a top 10 pick based off nothing. Like if he had no production or anything in college, I don't think a guy now can like propel themselves into some completely different stratosphere than they were in before at receiver. I mean, obviously we talked yesterday, Trayvon Walker, but like I don't think that happens for receivers anymore as much. Like it still moves them, it still changes things. You know, you get to the combine and when they post the unofficial times and everyone's running a 4.2, everyone loses their mind. But I think generally the league has learned a little bit that we need to at least see the production in college to go overboard with this
especially
stuff.
Speed. Like speed is obviously incredibly important at receiver, right? We understand that. I'm not saying anything crazy, but it's only worthwhile if the speed is matched up by ball tracking ability. Like once you get down the field and like that's the Tyreek Hill thing where just like, it's like, yes, he has explosive speed at the top end of the league, but what makes him, you know, wide receiver tier one, let's say, is that he's gets to the football. But you know, when the ball is in the air, he gets to it. And Troy Williamson could not get to the ball. So it didn't matter how fast he was. He couldn't figure out where the ball was in the air. Like and it's really hard. Like that's not an easy trait, right? That's a very hard skill to learn.
Well, there's two parts. There's tracking it, and then there's like actually figuring out whether you can let it drop to you or you have to go get it. Like Tyreek Hill is amazing at the catch point in a way that a guy that size has no business being. There's so many receivers that that don't ever go and get the ball. They always want it to drop to them. And the problem with that is DBs are always going to go and go up to try and get in the way of it. So if you're always letting it drop to you, there's a whole section of passes that are never going to get complete because you're not challenging for them. You're simply hoping that it will beat the coverage to make it to you in the first place. That, I think, is the biggest flaw in Jerry Jeudy's game right now. He's that type of receiver. He's not going to go up and get the ball almost ever. He's done it a couple of times. Like he had that famous play, I think, in his rookie season where he went up and mossed the dude, but almost never does that. So Judy's going to get wide the hell open more than almost anybody else in the league. But if the ball isn't right on point or if the DB is close enough to be able to make a play on it, there's a bunch of passes that will never make it through to Jerry Jeudy. And that's the difference between him and these like truly elite receivers. There's just a percentage of those plays that that differ at the catch point. Like that's a really important part. I think it caps how good a guy like Jeudy can be if they're never going to change that part of their game.
It's not an easy thing to change.
No, it's really not. I mean, I played wide receiver for a while and then until I moved to DB. I was not good at knowing when you had to go up and get it. I always wanted to let it drop to me. And that's a really hard thing to change. Like you can beat people, you can improve your route running, you can improve your hands, I always track the ball really well, but I would always basically let it try and drop in. And if someone was going to go up and challenge for it, they could break it up. I was just going to hope it like went past them and dropped into my hands.
I know that very well, my friend.
All right, where are we now? Okay, let's go back and revisit a little bit of the Joe Burrow to Patrick Mahomes conversation that we talked about earlier and that we talked about a lot last week. We had a bunch of emails about this. There was one really long one that was really well written. And actually, I want to find out the guy's name because there's no way I'm reading it out, but he deserves credit for at least articulating the thoughts behind it. I might find that in a bit because I can't find it off the top of my head. But anyway, the gist of this was Pete Schrager in particular, but wasn't alone, was saying, you know, if Burrow managed to beat Patrick Mahomes for the fourth time in a row, you couldn't construct the argument that Mahomes was a better quarterback. Can't do it. And me and Steve essentially both argued that that's ridiculous because of all of the evidence that says he is. Where were you before the game? And B, after the game has happened, where are you on Mahomes, Burrow versus Mahomes, Mahomes versus any other quarterback?
Nothing changed because of one game. Fun game to watch, I guess, by the end. Mm. But no, nothing changed. I think Mahomes is the going to go down as the best quarterback in history. I mean, he's on pace to at this point, right?
Sure.
5 AFC title games in 5 years, 3 Super Bowls now, maybe winning a second, et cetera, et cetera. I think the Burrow thing is really interesting because I think we have a hard time, and Mahomes is, they're all in this group, but we do have a hard time separating, trying to figure out what is the quarterback's contribution to this sport, to this team, to the offense, et cetera. And you cannot separate having two number one receivers with Joe Burrow.
Right.
Just as you can't separate having two number one receivers and an Andy Reid for most of Patrick Mahomes' career. Just as you can't separate the difference in Josh Allen once he gets Stephon Diggs and they create an offense that's built for him. I think that stuff is really, really hard to do. So, like, yes, I believe that they're all – those are probably the three best quarterbacks in the league. I'm willing to add Herbert and Lawrence. I think that'll happen next year. But I think this is where the – like, we have problems. And, like, just getting back into the obviously, like, probable racial undertones that come with saying that Mahomes is a good player, but Burrow is a good quarterback.
Right.
Like, those are massive issues as well. We just, like – man, I think they're both really great. I think Mahomes is probably a player that we've never really seen before.
Definitely.
His spatial awareness is incredible. Like I said before, I've been saying this a lot recently, so if you've listened to me on any other like podcast or radio hit I've done, you've heard me say this, but the whole like quarterbacks get outside the pocket and we praise them for keeping their eyes downfield. And it's like, that's not the difficult part. Like, you can get outside the pocket and look down the field. It's like, are you making a positive play once your body is turned one way and you're throwing back across your body, you're finding open receivers, you're being accurate with the football once you're outside the pocket? That is the hardest thing in the world to do. Guess who does it better than anyone we've ever seen? It's mm-hmm. Patrick Mahomes. Not to mention, he's also a savant in the pocket making decisions. It's incredible. He's changed his game this year and they changed the offense a bit this year to help him with that. So, yeah, I think Mahomes is hard not to say he's the best quarterback. And I people don't like what I'm about to say. People will not like what I'm about to say. But I think this is where we have this issue. And I want to say, like, separating quarterbacks and figuring out what they mean to the offense as a whole and trying to separate them from the offensive line, the play caller, the receivers and stuff like that. It's like why I'm very bullish on saying that, like, Dak Prescott, for example, is like a tier two quarterback. And I don't think the Bengals look that much different if Dak Prescott is the quarterback there rather than Joe Burrow, who I love as an LSU fan, but I don't think there's that much of a difference there if you gave him they've been really, really good on offense.
The Cowboys had arguably a better offense than the Bengals over the last couple of years. Mahomes' ability to do the exact dictionary definition of what you're not supposed to do as a quarterback and consistently make those plays is insane. When you consider the caliber of NFL player that can't do those plays, like, that was the biggest flaw a lot of the time in a Hall of Famer Brett Favre's game, was he kept trying to make those plays. Yeah. And you're like, Brett, you can't do that. You know, Mike Holmgren's on the sideline being like, what are you doing? You cannot make that throw. It's not possible to consistently make that. You will be punished by an interception. Mahomes makes those every single game, and they almost always come off. He always gets the ball where it's supposed to be. It's like, if a guy like Brett Favre, who has one of the best arms the game's ever seen, made the Hall of Fame, put up whatever it was, 60-something thousand passing yards, if he can't make that play, and you can all the time, I mean, that says it all in terms of what level he's on making these types of plays. The email we got in was from Philip Mendola, by the way. I'm not reading it out because it's giant, but it's well written and interesting. The one thing that I struggle with, and we talked about this a little bit, is I don't know if there's a way of separating the result of all this stuff put together with what the quarterback actually did to create that result, right? So, you know, even with that game, and we'll get to this with explaining the grade, but Mahomes versus Burrow, and it's like, oh, well, Mahomes is doing this with no receivers left, whereas Burrow had Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins. You're like, okay, sure. On the other hand, Joe Burrow is dealing with three turnstiles in the offensive line, and Patrick Mahomes is dealing with five of the best offensive linemen in the NFL.
The Chiefs only had a good game.
Right, which was basically unstoppable in that game. So you're like, so how do you separate those two things, right? Yes, Mahomes had crappy receivers and a great offensive line. Burrow had the opposite, which is better, which is more important, which was more relevant in that game. And then, you know, like Mike Francesa, is that his name? Was on First Take. Is that the thing? Like, they seem to be trying to create like the perfect storm of disaster fuel with this show. But he was on with Tom Brady retirement. He's like, Tom Brady's not the best regular season quarterback. He's not the best Super Bowl quarterback. And his argument for the Super Bowls was Joe Montana was better, right? And like, okay, Joe Montana played fantastically in a Super Bowl. His four wins speaks for itself. On the other hand, one of those wins, one of those Bengals Super Bowls, he tried to throw the game away right before he won it, which we always forget about because it didn't happen, so he won, right? But from a process standpoint, if he's simply punished for the mistake that he did make, the narrative changes. Tom Brady, the 28-3 game, right? Like, incredible comeback. But right before the Edelman absurd catch, right? Didn't he throw the ball right to Alford or something like that? Like, he tried to throw that game away.
He threw pick six to Alford in the game.
Right. But he, so he, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't take much. It doesn't even take any difference. Simply, like, the result changing from something that wasn't the quarterback's involvement for the entire narrative to flip on these guys. And but I think the sort of cumulative effect of the actual results, I mean, there's no other way of looking at it, right? Like, if Eli Manning doesn't go on those two runs to win two Super Bowls, nobody's, like, his career is rank average and nobody's talking about him for anything, let alone the Hall of Fame. But he did, so it matters. But these outcomes are always dependent on something else. Always. And that is what I find really difficult to separate. So when we're sort of focusing on, well, if Burrow wins four times in a row against Mahomes, like, at some point that does actually become relevant. But it's probably not one game, and it's probably not four games.
Yeah, exactly, right. It's not probably not even still four games.
Right, but it does at some stage become relevant because there's just no other way of judging these guys.
Yeah, in the sense that, like, this is the best we can do, then probably. But even that, it's tough. Like, I mean, Burrow is such a great example of, like, they got to the Super Bowl last year, and, like, he wasn't very good. And again, offensive line issues, I understand that, but he didn't have, like, the greatest Joe Burrow games, and, like, they won all four. They won three of them, right? Good last week, or good 2 weeks ago against the Bills, and kind of, I thought he was good-ish against the Chiefs last week. So it's like he's played five games now in the playoffs. He's played six games in the playoffs. He's been good for, like, half of them. But because they went to the Super Bowl and they went to the AFC Championship game again, it's like, well, he's this guy. And then, again, I go back to the Dak thing. The Dak issue really bothers me. But, like, just because they ran into the 49ers twice in the playoffs back-to-back years and that incredible defense, it's like he's not a good quarterback all of
right.
a sudden.
But, and you can do this for, like, every quarterback in NFL history.
Everyone.
Like, Joe Montana, for years, kept running into these Dallas teams in, you know, when they were at the peak of their powers. You're like, well, how many Super Bowls does Montana have if Dallas isn't there at the same time?
Yeah.
Like, and
once it happens, we forget that we had these narratives about
right.
these quarterbacks.
And with Tom Brady, you know, he's got all these rings and all these championships. You're like, okay, but you can change a really small number of plays to take away, like, the majority of Tom Brady's rings, right?
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
obviously you can't do, but the point being, like, without
you can do it like you like if we're saying like you can change a field goal in the Rams
yeah.
Super Bowl
you can
change
do
a
it.
Field goal in the Panthers Super Bowl you can change all the blah 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 like you're saying and it's like okay but we have to do it the other side too
right.
where it's like those guys would
of course.
Look a lot better
but you
also.
Can also do it without changing anything that Brady did which is the important thing,
yes
right
yes.
So the fact that Brady won as much as he did is the defining thing that makes us go Tom Brady
yes.
is the greatest of all time right
so someone
which,
said,
which does matter because it is important that Brady won seven Super Bowl rings and other like Dan Marino didn't win any right but if you can change most of that without affecting anything Brady did and you just say well if he got unlucky instead of lucky
yeah.
he wins one two rings
Tuck rule
what does that do to his legacy we're talking
yeah.
about a totally different career albeit a 23 year career and still leading but like we're talking about Peyton Manning's career instead of Tom Brady's now right and by definition, Peyton Manning's career has become secondary to Tom Brady's because he didn't win as much. And that is where I find this conversation really difficult, because I don't have the answer to that. I don't know how you square that circle and you say, how do you judge these guys if not by, like, at some point there is something to clutch and winning. I just don't know if it's possible to do it on a game-by-game basis.
There was I saw, like, people talking about this yesterday after the retirement, being like, is Tom Brady the GOAT, or is he just a guy who amassed a lot of stats because he played till he was 45?
Right.
And like, the issue with that is, like, why are you allowed to play until you're 45? Like, why is the NFL letting you play? Why are teams letting you be their starting quarterback until you're 45?
Yeah. Like, so he isn't Vinny Testaverde. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, because he's pretty good. So right. they'll let you be the quarterback.
But also, clearly, he's not just the sort of, like, a supercharged accumulator. Like, Vinny Testaverde retired, like, sixth on the all-time list because he hung on to when he was, like, 40. Yeah. Yeah. And he was, like, just this durable, big, like, monster. But he was never good. Like, again, relatively speaking, he was never a particularly good quarterback. He just hung on as long as basically anybody at the time. Like, Brady was always good, or at least once you get, you know, a couple of years into his career, that dude was consistently one of the best throughout his entire NFL career and hung on for 20 years. Like, so I just find that whole part of it really difficult. And that's why you get into these discussions, because I think people just default back to, I mean, wins or losses. They're the easy thing to point to. Yeah. Let's just go with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny to think about the early years in Brady's career where he was just an average quarterback.
Yeah.
And they won Super Bowls with him as an average quarterback.
I used to take so much crap because I kept getting brought on these New England radio shows to justify why Tom Brady's PFF grade stank during the early years of his career, despite him winning Super Bowls and them being amazing. You're like, because he's not playing that well. Like, he isn't.
Then then it's kind of like we're saying with Josh Allen and some other quarterbacks before. It's like, because you won games, they let you stick around. And then he became
incredible. Like, when he was at his best, he was grading as the number one quarterback at PFF. But, like, the first couple of years, I was getting just pelted every week going on these shows, being ripped to pieces why he wasn't grading that particularly well. Which is, it's this really hard thing to articulate. It's like, this is repeating itself over again with some of the Patrick Mahomes stuff of, like, you know, he's doing all this stuff, it's winning, therefore it's great. Okay, but is it, again, or how much of it is other circumstances coming in here? We'll continue this a little bit because the Burrow Mahomes thing is relevant with the explain the grade section. But first, I want to tell you about the easiest and most fun way to spice up playoff football season, Super Bowl football season. It's Underdog Fantasy and their Pick'em game. Just look for your favorite or least favorite player stats. Pick whatever you think they'll end up higher or lower than the total number in this week's game, and you can win up to 20 times your money in a single night. Underdog keeps it super simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players for your pick'em entry, get all your picks right, and you'll take home some cold, hard cash. It's simple to get started. Just head to underdogfantasy.com or download the app, sign up with promo code PFF, and Underdog will double your first deposit up to $100. That's Underdog Fantasy, promo code PFF, and get in on the action today. Right, explain the grade segment. Have we got our little explain the grade video, or did that?
I'm sure PFF will have me a low grade for that, but I'll keep it rolling.
Right, a lot of people are mad about this one because
I'm mad about it.
Patrick Mahomes won the game, therefore he should have a higher grade than Joe Burrow. He also Joe Burrow had interceptions. He put the ball in harm's way, and that's problematic for people. So I think this is actually a good explain the grade segment because Burrow ends up with, 26 for 41, 270 yards, 1 touchdown, 2 interceptions, which is a passer rating of 70.2. Mahomes, on the other hand, goes 29 of 43 for 327 yards, 2 touchdowns, 0 interceptions for a passer rating of 105. But Burrow's PFF grade is slightly higher than Mahomes, and people think that we are crazy for that. Really, it's focused on the Burrow side of things. Because look, Mahomes played well. When you factor in the fact that he was doing it with no receivers and a busted ankle, neither of which the PFF grade factors in, I think absolutely boost him higher and say that he was every bit as good. I'm fine with that. But my point is the Joe Burrow side of this, because I think Burrow played pretty damn well in that game. And when you consider his I think the interceptions are an interesting topic because – so we gave Burrow one turnover-worthy play in the game. I think there's another one that's on the borderline, but his turnover-worthy play is the one right at the start of the game where he throws the ball right to rookie Trent McDuffie. Threw it right to his hands, should have been a pick, wasn't. And this is where that stat is interesting. The stat is turnover-worthy plays, right? So plays you think should be turnovers, not could be, should be. Like, that's the threshold we're shooting for here. So lofting the ball, like a 50-50 jump ball is not turnover-worthy because by definition it's 50-50, not it's going to be picked off more often than it's not. That's the kind of threshold. So when you look at his two actual interceptions, remember he had a third one negated. So let's cover the negated one first. There are people out there that have argued that was such a bad pass that had the safety simply not gone to torpedo him and gone hit early, but tried to cut in front of it instead, it would have been picked off and it's terrible. Those people are out of their minds. That's a good pass that would have hit his receivers right, or hit his receiver right in the hands, but for the safety getting there too early and annihilating the guy, causing the ball to bounce for a pick. That's a fine pass that should under no circumstances of be deemed a turnover-worthy play. It's nothing. It's, if anything, it's a positive play that gets negated because of the correct defensive pass interference penalty. The second actual interception was the ball lofted down the sideline to T. Higgins that is broken up by the safety and then ends up landing in the hands of the corner. Now, people have argued, well, that's a forced throw into double coverage. It isn't really, though. Like, if you look at it...
No, I think he just underthrows it.
And it's really marginal.
By a touch.
Like, it's
not a bad decision. Like,
it's exactly what we talked about before, which is it's underthrown because the receiver is waiting for it to drop into his hands. If he doesn't, if T. Higgins actually does what T. Higgins normally does, which is turn, high point the ball, mm-hmm. he wins the jump ball. It's a big, productive play, and nobody's saying anything about it. Instead, he thinks it's going to beat the DB, and it probably does most of the time, except the safety makes a spectacular diving one-handed pass breakup and gets just enough of it, and all of a sudden that turns into an interception. So the few things I would point out about that. One, if that guy doesn't make that play, and I think people need to understand how good a play that is from the safety. I think that's an amazing diving pass breakup. If he doesn't make that play, it's probably a catch, and it's a well-thrown ball because of that. If you're nitpicking the location, you say, yeah, it's half a yard underthrown, because if it's half a yard further, the safety literally can't make that play, and then it is a catch and a touchdown. But two, it isn't really double coverage, because the cornerback's involvement in that play is over right up until the point it lands in his hands, because he's watching.
Oh, it was schemed up for this exact thing to happen, and they got it right.
He beats him on a double move, the corner is trailing way behind the play, and then simply because the safety manages to bat it up in the air, it's like, oh, look, the ball lands in my hands. Like, that's not double coverage. That is one-on-one effectively with the safety, and the safety made the play. So we don't charge that as a turnover-worthy play. Even if you just look at, like, passes thrown into double coverage, those are picked off, like, 10% of the time, which is up from 2% of the time for any other pass, but is not, again, by definition, turnover-worthy. Like, you're supposed to challenge double coverage sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's not turnover-worthy. The other one is the interesting one, because that is the one up the seam to T. Higgins again, where it looks terrible. Because right at the point Burrow is letting go of the ball, T. Higgins tries to adjust his route outside of the DB and sort of take what is a seam, tries to turn it like a seam fade, and all of a sudden the corner is basically just standing where the ball's about to arrive and catches it and picks it off. I don't think it's good. In fact, I think it's bad, whatever. Like, there's debate as to, is T. Higgins supposed to stay inside? Is he supposed to bend that outside? There's a few things at play. Number one, it's different to most looks the Bengals have run this exact play against over the course of the season because it's cover zero.
There's no safety. I'm mad about this play.
So like, all of a sudden,
fan, I'm so mad about this play.
Right. All of a sudden, T. Higgins has an inside release against a DB with nobody in the middle of the field. So, and Burrow sort of sees this and puts the ball in the air. Now, what he didn't do was lead him into that space where the no safety is and take advantage of the fact that your 6'4" guy has inside leverage. And if you put it in the middle of the field, essentially there's no way this ball can do anything other than a favorable pass to Higgins. He's rushed. He puts the ball in the air. It's short. I think it's bad whatever happens, but the fact that Higgins tries to adjust that side effectively turns it into a nightmare.
Wide receiver QB miscommunication.
It's definitely a miscommunication. The question is, and this is always a very difficult thing to determine, but how bad is it if the miscommunication doesn't happen? And this is one of the funny things, because people criticize PFF for this generally in the other direction. I think one of the things that gets said about us is we guess too much. Like, you're saying, what if? What we're actually doing in this play is saying we can't tell how bad this is if T. Higgins doesn't try and adjust his route outside. If he stays where he is and the ball is put where it is, how bad is that? And we're basically saying we can't tell, so we're not giving it a turnover-worthy play, because it might not be. It might just be like a forced throw that would be a minus 0.5 by our numbers and not like a really egregious throw. So ironically, we're actually taking the determination of we don't know if it's Burrow's fault. We don't know if it's Higgins' fault. There's basically no way of telling that from the information available to us. So we're kind of saying we're going to hedge and not downgrade either of them too hard. And I think that's the soundest way of doing that. It looks terrible because at the point after the ball is thrown, all you see is like DB jump, like standing there and catching it. But I think from a process standpoint, I don't think it's terrible for Burrow.
Yeah, it just sucks that it happened like the second he decides to make the throw is when T. Higgins goes the other way. And again, like you said, it's like not a common play.
Right.
You weren't expecting to get – and then it's then it's like, you know, I mean, again, this is not on us, but then we're just talking about like, do you read that? If you have a slot fade, do you read that and say, let me stay inside of it because I know that's where the space is and it's an easier pitch and catch if I – run it more of a skinny post,
right?
Or do I just keep running on my route? But then the thing is, like, because he took such an inside release to begin with, he fooled Burrow. That's what I think happened, is like he took such an inside release when in his head thinking inside release, I'm gonna get the DB turn his hips and I'm gonna break on my fade route,
right,
on my slot fade. And Burrow was like, well, A, I'm under pressure, B, there's some space here for me to throw the football into. And then again, the timing was like perfectly bad.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing, is that I think there is an element sometimes where sometimes you can just get unlucky. Like, again, sometimes receivers and quarterbacks are on different pages. Sometimes it's obvious who screwed up, right?
Yeah.
There are certain times where you can see what happened and who made the mistake, and that's easy enough. There are other times where I don't know. There are other times where it's difficult to know, but somebody did. And then I think there's a third category where sometimes you just get unlucky and it actually makes sense what both guys did.
Yeah.
You know, and it just, they did the different things and therefore it was a bad result. Now the question is, what do you do with a play like that from a grading standpoint? Because this play, as a minor downgrade or as a significant turnover-worthy play downgrade, would affect Joe Burrow's grade reasonably significantly, right? So do you say the buck stops with the quarterback and this is his responsibility, even if it isn't, you know, even if it isn't really, and downgrade him hard for it? Or do you say this is unlucky, and whether or not it's his fault, whether or not it's understandable, we're just going to sort of say no harm, no foul, and not be wrong in downgrading somebody too hard for something that actually wasn't their fault? Because that, I think, is what this grade kind of swings on, is that people look at that and say, that's an objectively ridiculous throw. And it isn't really. Like, it's definitely not good. And I think it is bad because of the location, which was there because of he was rushed. But when you look at what happened on the play and the reasons it was sort of, the reasons that the receiver did what he did and what Burrow did what he did, I think you can kind of put it down to it's bad luck and it's a good defensive play.
You're the one with the knowledge of the system more than I am. So I mean, you're making a good point. You're making a good point. That's all I got.
I mean, look, this is what we do in explaining the grade, right? We're not saying this is infallible. We're not saying 100% this was not Burrow's fault. What we're saying is we don't know. And so far as I can tell from, you know, post-game comments and stuff, nobody else does either know who was at fault. So absent of that definitive information, we're effectively saying there's not enough information on this.
I would bet it's still a negatively graded throw.
It is.
Yeah. So
because of that location.
Yeah.
But what we're saying is there's only so hard you can downgrade that without knowing what it would have looked like if T. Higgins had stayed where Burrow thought he was going to be. And that, I think, is the difference, is it looks ridiculous, but I don't think you can square what T. Higgins did and know how that would have looked had he stayed on his route or with his leverage. Like, that's the difference. So
big play in the game too.
Right. Huge play in the game.
Huge play
in determining like what you think of Burrow's performance. I mean, you take away that interception or either of the interceptions from a stat sheet, his passer rating probably jumps 15 points.
This is not grade related, but just thinking about the two quarterbacks in that game, it's just like the difference, so much of that difference is Burrow. You know, they did a really good job. I believe they played a bunch of cover two, like a ton of cover two, the Chiefs did, and it really took away what they often want to do, right, is to throw the ball down the sideline and stuff like that. And it forced Burrow off his first read, his first side that he was looking at, and by that time it was like, it's over. Chris right. Jones is in your face and it's over.
Yeah.
And the flip side is Mahomes being able to do Mahomes things, which is like, I'm not getting so much pressure. These were really good pockets. They certainly weren't Eagles pockets, but they were very good pockets. And then Mahomes just flourishes because he looks at his first read, it's not there, he moves back and he finds, you know, MVS on a rope on the post route in the end zone. And then he finds Kelsey and him doing the telepathy that they always do, where he breaks off his route and the ball is already there in the end zone, and all these type of plays that were only Mahomes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was really my favorite part of the game, is that the contrast between the pockets, I think, were really the biggest difference in the game.
So that's going to do it. I think overall, I think Burrow played better than a stat sheet is the point we're getting at with this. I don't expect everyone to agree with every point we made about his grade overall, but I think the hysteria about his grade versus Mahomes' grade is largely driven by those interceptions that looked really bad for Burrow, one of which I don't think was bad at all, and the other of which I think you have to factor in the extra context, which we have decided to err on the side of not penalizing him too hard for it, because I think there's too much unknown about that.
Yeah.
So anyway,
degree of difficulty on Burrow's shoulders for most of this season, no running game, offensive line getting worse as the season went on because of the injuries. It's been tough.
Yeah. So that's Explain the Grade for today. That's the rest of today's show. Myself and Seth are going to be back tomorrow. And then Steve will be back for Monday's show. And then me and Steve are off to Phoenix for Radio Row and the Super Bowl, et cetera, et cetera. So we will talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Take it easy.